Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 628, Judas and the Black Messiah. Was there a the in the title? Did I miss a the?
I don't think so.
Okay.
You put it in the right place.
Okay, cool. I don't know if it was the Judas and the Black Messiah. I get my the's all confused.
Also, you know what? You're outnumbered broadcasting from the, we're all in different locations now, and I don't know how long. I mean, it's been a while, and for the foreseeable future, so that opening.
It's been a year.
I'm not writing a new one. I've already written like four of these things, five of these things.
I just keep thinking, I'm like, I'm not there, liar.
See, I make it up by doing this part of it in the opening. Let's go around the virtual table, and we can all introduce ourselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. And joining us today from the Cup of Soul podcast, it's Katia Woods. Hey, how's it going?
Nice to be here. I feel like I'm not in the basement, but I am in my spare room. So it's kind of feels like a basement.
It's better. We used to broadcast from an actual
Legitimate closet. Yeah.
For a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I moved houses, and so the studio, we couldn't leave the studio in the old house. The new owners were weird about that. And yeah.
Hey, we're here. Okay.
Yeah. We're let us in.
You just build that into the contract next time. Yeah. But okay.
So while I was having the basement of the house finished, like we had to like tuck away literally in a closet next to the hot water heater. No, the sump pump. That's what we were next to. So
I mean, there were comics there. Joe was happy, but
yeah, he didn't say like two words for the whole episode because he was just reading books. It was,
and then I saw your organizing system, and I almost had a heart attack. So
it's
bad.
I'm so far behind.
I had to walk away.
I'm like, if you're looking for a part time job, you can come over and get them all in order.
At least it wasn't like the laundry room where you know people are like.
That was our first studio.
Oh, so, well, before we get into the movie itself, shameless plugs, don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you find podcasts, you can find us. Also, while you're there, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. Check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and if you would be so kind, through your social media platform of choice, share an episode so your friends and or loved ones are aware of the show. People who were kind enough to share an episode, this is over the last 2 weeks because I forgot last week, so brace yourself.
And take a week off and it all goes to hell.
I know. Jason Weese, Aaron Marlowe, Pat Andy, Gabriel Lugo, Heather Sachs, Travis Tewitt, Jeff Wildman, Ralph Tribble, Chris Williams, Chris Falls, Julianne Jordan, Brent Smith, Ron Johnson, Tammy Sherman Powers, Chris Sanders, Librarian Cynthia, Lane Levanway, and then sliding on over to Twitter, Invasion of the Remake, Nerd Adonis, The Cinema Guys, Katia Woods. Thank you.
Oh.
Yeah. Brad Hyen will write. It's okay. Even though she's on this episode, she shared an episode she wasn't on, so she still gets the credit.
Brad Hyen rule is in effect.
Yes. Mike and Oscar, Ronnie Castle, Josh Dykstra. It's a Fandom Thing podcast, In Session Film, Cinema Recall, although Cinnamon Recall sounds really delightful.
Not if it's recalled.
No, all cinnamon is good cinnamon. Rosa Reviews, Ryan Terry from the Forza Crowd podcast, Minorities Report podcast, Matt Niglia, Geek to Me Radio, Feelin' Film, Trivia Chick or Chic, I'm not sure how they're saying that, and Renegade Pop Culture. So thank you very much for sharing the show. And finally, one last plug. Don't forget, we have a Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month, you get all sorts of bonus content. You help out, and we like you a little extra.
And the comics are gone.
Oh, Joe's blown through all
his
comics.
They have been mailed. Oh. They are out the door.
There we go. So, yes. Anyway, Judas and the Black Messiah.
Again, I'm sure you guys talked about it. To me, this is very interesting. In the release model, where these are top-level box office movies that, I guess, Warner Brothers and Disney and... other companies are just like, I'm not sitting on them anymore.
Yeah.
Like, we're not waiting to the summer of 2021.
I feel bad that this movie couldn't get released theatrically in a traditional time period. Because I think that this movie would have been a breakout hit. I think this would have been $150 million box office film. It would have been one of those, it would have been one of those surprise releases where people didn't see it coming and it ended up being a big deal. That's my gut.
Do you think it would have been like one of sometimes you get these really, really good films that are art house movies, and then after they're done with their week or two at the art house, then they're like boom at the Cineplex and they're just there forever? Because like, do you think it would have been like that, or would it have just hit the ground running?
Like, my guess would have been that the rollout on this movie, just from a pure marketing standpoint, would have been, I mean, similar to what we would see now, it would have been a February release to either tie into Black History Month or Martin Luther King weekend. I know that's not February, but that time frame. And I think that it would have gained a lot of buzz in that regard, and it would have broke out the same way. And I know these movies aren't serious like this one is, or true to life like this one, but the same way that, like, you know, that Ride Along broke out in that time period, Get Out broke out in that time period. Like, I think this movie would have followed that trajectory.
I agree. I think we underestimate, there is a starvation for Black history to be seen. People are under this assumption that there's been a lot of pictures like this, and there haven't. Yeah. You know, Chaka keeps that at best. There hasn't been a lot. Hollywood has not been thirsting to make movies about things that happened to Black people other than slavery and Martin Luther King. There's been documentaries, which is a whole different spiel. You know what I mean? With documentaries, I think you have more freedom. People are more willing to go down that wheel, like, you know, the James Baldwin, and the list goes on and on. There's a really good one right now called Black Art on HBO. But not like this. I think people in the inner city, not just in New York, Chicago, L.A., I think people in Milwaukee would have came out. I think in people in New Orleans and Memphis would have came out. Because this is, you know, the Black Panthers were all over the country. And I just recently learned, forgive my ignorance, it really big in the U.K., you know, as we learned through Mangrove and stuff like that. So it's just, I think it's a theme. There's a thirst here because, again, we don't get taught things in school. You know what I mean? Our history is very skewed. And you grow up and you think you know stuff. And then you're like, wow, this happened. Why don't I know this? Why didn't anybody teach us this?
That's, you know, like the opening scene of the series Watchmen. Like when they go into Tulsa, and it's just like, I had no idea. Like, I had no clue that was even a thing.
Watching this movie, I mean, and I was not familiar with this story, but it's interesting when you see in film, when you look at J. Edgar Hoover. And like when I grew up, you always hear about, oh, J. Edgar Hoover was the first director of the FBI. And you always think of him as kind of like this hero, this great person. And then you see this movie and you're like, oh, like this is what he was doing? And you just start to realize that history has been told from a certain perspective.
Well, yeah, J. Edgar Hoover was shady AF,
yeah, he's kind of a scumbag.
But they used to, like, he used to be like...
Oh, I mean, he bankrolled his own TV show, right? The Untouchables, like, he, you know, and they like, right. made a big deal about, like, in conjunction with the FBI. That's because if you wanted to be conjunctified, you were going to tell the stories that J. Edgar Hoover wanted you to tell, which then
right.
got a generation of people to be like, this guy is amazing. I love the FBI, blah, blah, yeah.
That's exactly. So it's like you grow up thinking one thing because of the perspective of the stories, and then you start to see how things really were, and you start to see the struggle from the perspective that it should be told from. And so this film I thought was fascinating, and I didn't know the story, but you get a couple of powerhouse performances like Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield are two of the best actors.
If you look at there is an interview out there, I think you can find it on YouTube, from William O'Neill. It's from The Eyes and the Prize, which again is a series, PBS. That's where like the interview, that the opening sequence, you know, in case you want to see it for yourself, it's very chilling, and you know, this you're not going to feel better about the guy, but it gives you some insight on all this stuff and how the FBI really manipulated people into helping them with these little agendas, so to say. And that's really your point of entry, because there is no documentation, as we know, that of the actual interaction between the FBI agent and William O'Neill, because everything was done off the books. And technically, for this conversation, only two people knew. One of them was Hoover and this gentleman and O'Neill, and two of them are dead. So how do you trace that? Do you know what I mean? So I think that's the other challenge. You know, Black history hasn't been notated accurately and hasn't been notated, period. So when you do these things, we have, of course, the what happened to Fred. And you know how they display that mattress and horrible and all of that, and that's horrible in itself. Just to give a little more context, my question to Shaka was, why weren't there more people from the Black Panthers involved? Because you have people that are alive, and you know, some of them are in prison, but a lot of them are alive, and they chose not to. So a couple people did, but a majority of them did not choose to participate. So, you know, I think obviously they don't trust Hollywood, don't trust the system, having gone through, and probably some of them don't want to relive that, you know, especially if you were there when he got shot. So it's hard. The fact that he was able to put something together is pretty remarkable, because how do you do it when you have the puzzle is like
incomplete? Well, and when you talk about them not wanting to participate, like also keep in mind when the movie was being assembled from a political standpoint, right? Like,
sure.
Like, if I mean, you see a president who was, I mean, fuck it, I don't care, who was weaponizing the FBI for his own personal agenda. And so if you were somebody who already had been through a government doing something like that, like how willing are you going to be to reinvite that into your life when you're 70? You know what I mean? Like, you're just going to be,
and you're not even sure, and you're not even sure your words aren't going to be twisted in a way that fits the director's narrative.
Yeah, there's so many places where that can fall apart and not be the story you want out there, that you're just like, you know what? I'm out.
Right.
Plus, we know Hollywood is really, let's be honest, right? These people aren't sitting in an office saying, I want to tell the most accurate story. They're thinking about what is the most entertaining,
yeah,
what's going
exactly.
to get. Because again, this was pre-pandemic when they put this all together. They're like, what's going to get the butts in the seats? You know what I mean? What's going to be the most salacious story? You have all of that going on. Do you know what I mean? So I understand it, you know, and you got to respect it. And I think it was hard for Frank Hepburn's widow to, you know, I think they were very explicit that certain things were not to be shown in a certain way. You know what I mean?
Do you mean from Frank's family's point of view, or that the creators didn't want to show certain things?
I think they had, I don't want to say Fred Hampton Jr. as much because he wasn't alive. Sure. You know what I mean? But I think Deborah goes by a different name now. She was there when he mm-hmm. was killed. So I think her personal trauma, just the fact that that would have really left you even more traumatized because he was shot 90 to 94 times. Do we need to see that on film in order for us to get the message?
And I don't think that we do.
I disagree. I think no, we absolutely do. I think that not from a from like a purient standpoint, but like think like that's awful that what they did, and that needs to be documented, and people need to see what occurred for them to really understand the severity of it. You know what I mean?
But did they show it on film, though?
No, they don't show it on film. I feel like you get it. You think you get it. And I think, it was out of respect
sure.
for the
sure.
family.
Sure.
You know,
mm-hmm.
there are documentaries and things like that where they hone that point in. You see the mattress where, you know, it was soaked with his blood. And, because again, that was done to deter other people that had any ideas of wanting to uprise and organize. If you go down this road, this is what will happen to you.
Like, yeah, I agree. I got the idea of what happened when you see all the bullets fired and all the people that did get shot and the blood and everything. Like, I think they were respectful to his family, so they didn't have to relive seeing him get shot. But like, I felt like he was. I totally like what they did to him, and the whole movie and the whole story was so bad. And also shooting up that entire apartment full of people. It just like I got the idea, and it was done in a way that was respectful, but also got across how terrible of an event that it was. So like, I agree. I think it would have been gratuitous, although it definitely would have hammered the point home. But like, I got it. This whole movie was 2 hours of like, wow, the way that, you know, these people were treated and the betrayal by the government. And it was eye opening.
I don't even know if I'd
sure.
call it betrayal, because someone have to be on your side to betray you, you know?
So
I know what you
but
mean.
I mean, like, betrayal of trust, government and the people. And
I think Jesse Plivin's character kind of was on his side. Mm-hmm. Sort of.
He was on his side.
He did what he...
And...
Yeah, that's true. But he wasn't... You know, you get the scene with Martin Sheen where he's, you know, asking about Jesse Plevin's daughter bringing home a black man. And Jesse Plevin's is like, why are we even having this conversation? So, like, there are degrees of people being on... willing to do things for their job without crossing a line. But then you've got other people who don't care about that line. And Jesse Plevins is forced to make a decision.
I get that he maybe he wasn't as bad as J. Edgar Hoover, but he was still on J. Edgar Hoover's side.
Absolutely. Yeah. At the end of the day,
he didn't stand up.
You know what I mean? Yeah. The manipulation also of knowing that O'Neill's weaknesses, and he knew that mm-hmm. he would have no morals. You know what I mean? I mean, also in the movie, just for the record, O'Neill was a career criminal. Like, it wasn't just car theft. It was a myriad of other things. So we're not dealing with an individual. That's why they picked it, because you already was morally mm-hmm. corrupt. You couldn't just take a regular guy off the street that didn't have any of those fallacies. You know what I mean? So they definitely picked the guy that already was on the wrong side of everything. They didn't care about anybody but himself.
Yeah, and Roy Mitchell, the FBI agent that Jesse Plemons plays, I mean, he manipulated him from start to finish. I mean, he knew the guy that he had and was able to do exactly, like, every time he was like, you know, oh, well, I need to get paid for what I'm doing here. And he's like, yeah, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. Like, he was willing to do whatever it took. He knew.
And Mitchell was, that was his kind of calling card, or what he was best known for, was his ability to get people to talk. Like, that's why he worked on a lot of high profile cases. And he references one where he went to Mississippi. That's the one that story he tells is the basis for the film Mississippi Burning. So,
oh, is that right?
So he was involved in a lot of high profile cases, and there were some times when he was doing the right, and I think that's how he justified it to himself, right? Of like, I'm the great moderate, and the Klan and the Black Panthers are the same thing. And it's like, well, Are they though? But
yeah, I think that's your that's the reveal right there. When a character says that the Klan and the Black Panthers are the same, you know he's
right.
not a good dude.
Right.
I mean that right there.
And
there's
that
away.
If
that
William
right
O'Neill
there,
is Judas, then Mitchell is Pontius Pilate.
Yeah. Oh, good call. Yeah, absolutely.
Very good.
I went to Catholic school, so some of it stuck.
And you know, because it is that type of thing where, like, I really wasn't the one whose idea it was, but you didn't stop it.
Right. Exactly. Right. 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 You did go. You went along.
Which
with
I get.
It.
Which also, again, like, okay, to his credit, like, what are you going to do against J. Edgar Hoover? I don't know that he necessarily, but like, could have stopped him. But he also could have, like, well, I'm not participating.
So okay, okay. In retrospect, yes, he could have done that. On the flip side of that, though, when they're having that conversation, that is definitely a conversation that is where J. Edgar Hoover is saying, without saying, your job is on the line here. Like, depending on how answer this question. I agree that there's a moment where you can either lie on your morals or you can keep providing for your family. And he is faced with a decision where it's like, I could lose this job that I've probably worked my ass off for. And then
it's a government job,
and then
right?
He's
building towards,
you are out of law enforcement.
He's building towards his pension. And you know, I get the conflict. I just don't know that. Ultimately he was all that conflicted.
I think there are moments where he is conflicted, but the bottom line is, he did what he had to do to get that guy.
I think he believed that the Klan and the Black Panthers were the same thing. And that is the beginning and the end of the conversation. Whether he totally agreed with what J. Edgar Hoover was doing, okay, he was a little uncomfortable. That's fine. But those were his beliefs, that they were the same. And right there shows you what side he was on. And, you know, I mean, if that's true, again, I don't know if that conversation, that could have been a dramatization.
That in itself would be like, I don't know, a documentary or film in itself.
I think it is. I think it absolutely is.
You know what I mean? And I think it also goes to show you that you can't have one person in power for so long, because they get very comfortable and
entitled.
You know, they're getting like king-like ideologies that, you know, you can't stop me because I know where all the bodies are buried, and, you know, I helped you with such and such. I think it's one of the reasons why you don't see anybody in that position for so long anymore, you know.
Yeah, term limits are there for a reason.
Yes, you need to, that term needs to be limited. It's just to make sure you get some fresh blood and some new ideologies in there, because like you just said, that you have people who get into power and think that these folks work for them instead of
weird.
Us.
Yeah, like we just went through this or something.
Strange. I mean, it is, and it's like, it's almost like, you know, it's like I sometimes feel guys where I'm like, did we learn a different U.S. history? Like, you know, how the Constitution gets thrown around and how rights and powers, and I was like, you know, it's a working document, and I'm like, on top of that, there's a reason why you have the things in it, so that when someone like that does come along, it kind of stops you, because if you don't have those things, we would be in a whole different type of situation
Well, let's get into the story about William O'Neill and how he's enlisted by the FBI and kind of get into the telling.
Well, I did want to say,
it's kind of funny, but it isn't.
I did want to say quickly is our two leads, I think, we've seen both of them a lot recently, probably in the last 5 years. Both of them were in Get Out. You know, we've seen Daniel Kaluuya in Black Panther, and Lakeith Stanfield in
Widows.
Yeah, but he was also
a movie that is very, very undervalued, but it's a good movie, and he's great in it.
Oh, I mean, how creepy!
He's great. That scene,
intimidating dude.
So it's great to see these two guys together on screen at the same time, and able to play off each other. And I feel like this is the next generation of actors that we're getting to see, like, come into their own. which is
yeah, like I said earlier, they're two of the best actors working today, and I really like Daniel Kaluuya and everything that he's done, and Lakeith Stanfield is seriously one of my favorite actors.
I always
so
perk
versatile.
Up when I'm like, oh, he's in this? Like, he's...
Mm-hmm.
Every time. Oh, my gosh. Totally. Think about the different roles that he's played since... since Get Out, like,
but those scenes that he has are amazing.
Right. But in since then, look at all the things that he's gone on to do, like, whether it's weird stuff like Sorry to Bother You, which I absolutely adore that film. But, you know, when he's doing that, or if he's in Knives Out, or he's doing this, which is such a serious
Atlanta
performance. And, like the yeah, it, yeah, and then the show Atlanta. Yeah, I mean, he has done so much stuff. But really, in this film, he's a character, you know, a human being that is carrying so much mm-hmm. weight. And of course, being an undercover informant, he can't let it be known what he's actually doing. And so while all this is happening around him, he can't say anything. And this isn't narrated like an internal monologue, but you just see it with his eyes, what he's thinking and feeling. And there's so much power to that. And he does a phenomenal job acting with his, you know, physical features.
You need so much subtlety in a role like this, because you have to convey to the audience what you're thinking without also making people question why everyone in that car didn't know what he was thinking. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, sure.
So,
sure,
like,
sure.
if he's too over the top, then you're like, come on, everybody knows he's acting weird. They'd put a bullet in his head right now, and
you'd be sweating. Right. Yeah,
yeah. Why is he sweating so much?
It is. I think Lakeith he's like an artist.
Yeah,
that's the best way I can put it. He's not somebody that's really interested in being famous. Mm-hmm. He likes doing the work. If it were up to him, he wouldn't do any of these interviews. He would mm-hmm. just be in his little world and work with the people that he's working.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think for Daniel, we are in for a treat and for a long ride. The way he chooses roles is very specific. This is not a guy that's just doing stuff just to be doing stuff. Like, we know some people where we're like, God, why are you making this movie, right? He's not one of those folks. And when you speak to him, he's also someone not interested in being famous. He's not on social media, has no interest in being on social media. But unlike Lakeith, is more open to talk about his work, right? You don't know anything about his personal life. What you know is by happenstance. It's not him talking about it. You know, he's very close to his family, loves his mom. But you get that this is a guy, he loves to act, and he's very purposeful. And he wasn't going to do this unless he could do it right. And from Chicago people, I'm not from Chicago, so if any of you guys are or closer to that, they said he got the accent down. And most importantly, the family felt he embodied. They signed off on him. Mm. So I think, I do think Mr. Kaluuya will make it all the way to April in the top five. You know what I mean? I think he's just riveting. And he's beautiful to look at, you know. I don't just mean that as in a handsome way. It's just, you know, there's a guy up there that cares, and he's putting in the work. Because again, we've all seen it where you're like, oh God, why are you playing this? You know what I mean? And then we got to sit through it to the end so we can speak accurately about it. But we really want out, but not with him. I think with him, we're always... we want to see more.
Yeah, it's funny when you say you want to see more. My biggest complaint about this movie, and I think Kevin and Joe will be aghast when I say this. I wish, because I never say it, I wish it was longer.
It's quick. It's a quick 2 hours.
It is quick, too. Not a hard two.
And, and I feel like there was a lot of story that didn't get told. That because...
yeah,
they were trying to hit that 2 hour mark, and I would have enjoyed this movie in a lot of ways. Kind of reminded me of The Godfather, and that it's this kind of epic tale, and I think it would have benefited and justified a 2 hour and 45 minute runtime to kind of get
probably
a little bit more complexity, you know.
So also, you know, we got to understand we're movie people. We love movies. That's our home. We can sit in the theater,
watch five films, that's a great day for us. But the average person does not have that type of patience. So they're probably thinking like, are these people going to stay for two hours plus?
Yeah, if you can give definitely. The Departed 2.5 hours, you can give this 2.5 hours, right? Like that's
yeah. Yeah. I mean, for film people, yes, but for general audiences, again, when you're talking about is this movie going to be a huge smash hit, and it comes out and it's based on it's a historical film, and as soon as you start going close to 3 hours, people are going to start
on paper.
Like,
apparently, on paper, it sounds like an eat your vegetables experience, you know, and I think the Departed is a good kind of reference point too, because it's a lot closer to something like that in terms of like I feel weird saying from an enjoyment standpoint because I know that this is ultimately an awful story, but it is a story that sucks you in and you want to see where it's headed, and I would think for a good chunk of America they don't know where it's headed, right? Like even though it's a true story and it's historical, like I would bet most people walking into a theater, especially white people, that they've never heard the name Fred Hampton, or if they have, it's like that sounds vaguely familiar. Like there's a large portion of America that could be truly shocked by the ending of this movie, even though it's part of the historical record.
I think that's very true.
I had no idea about this story. Well, I didn't.
If you remember in Trial of the Chicago 7, this is the picture that they show him to freak him out when he gets so upset. They're showing him a picture of Fred Hampton, and that's when he gets like really just kind of loses his shit.
Also, Calvin Harrison Jr., another great actor that needs to do more work. He is Fred Hampton in Trial of the Chicago 7.
Yeah.
In it for like if you blink, you miss it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it ties into why Bobby got even more upset because
and I thought it was interesting having just seen the Trial of the Chicago 7. Don't they show the picture of Bobby Seale in this movie?
They show a courtroom drawing of it.
Like,
yeah,
or the drawing of him all tied up, right? J. Edgar Hoover is like, Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. I mean, at least I had some context there because of having just watched that film. And but I didn't know this story or how it was going to end. And it was fascinating that it was eye opening, right? And raging and to know that things like this were going on. And also, I mean, that's a tough role for Lakeith Stanfield to play because you've got this career criminal that was just a kid. I mean, you know, he was 17 years old and a career criminal. And then he's forced with, well, you're either going to go away to jail or you're going to do this thing. And, you know, he ultimately took the selfish route.
Right,
that he made the selfish
choice.
Hold on. He ultimately made this decision that only benefited him. And look at the damage that he did for the movement, for his people, for history. I mean, all to stay out of jail for stealing cars and other crimes. And look at the damage he did. It's unbelievable.
Well, I think he used his 17-year-old brain, right? Like, there was no forward thinking. Like, and
that's why they enlisted
him. That's exactly right. He was a 17-year-old who didn't think past his nose because no 17-year-old does that. And he worried about himself, and he got himself caught up in a situation that he could not get himself out of.
And when he got further into it, once he's enlisted and years, months go by and time goes by and he sees what they're doing, I think he starts to realize
he has a character turn, but it's too late, you know?
Right.
Also, you got to remember he wasn't political. That's the key thing. Like when he's asking, you talked about the opening of the film, right? But we already know what his hustle is. It's funny, but it's not, right? You're like, what the hell? Like, really, dude? That's how you're stealing cars? Like, what happened to just doing the thing, right? So that alone gives you a good idea where he's not the sharpest knife in the tool shed. And then when they're talking, right? And he's like asking him, like, how do you feel about Malcolm X? How do you feel about Martin Luther King? Like, he's like, and he's like, oh, he's not political. So perfect. So he really is not connected.
I totally get what you're saying with his views of politics, but I think it did show. I mean, I think it was very impactful and very smart what he was doing, because his ploy that we see is he is not you know, Jesse Plemons' character, he says, why didn't you just hold him up at gunpoint, right?
Exactly.
And then he's smart. I think he's actually smart because he says the badge is scarier than a gun. And I think that is so relevant to today
still, and
the things that we see going on. With,
or like, why didn't you just take that? I don't know. I'm not a car thief, but, you know, isn't there like a little kitten situation where you just take the freaking car without involving the people?
Sure, but, of course.
You know what I mean? It's like it seemed. It's like you just said, Joe, he used his 17-year-old brain to make it job harder than it needs to be. Because maybe maybe it's a thrill, you know, the idea I'm going in there and I'm using this badge to scare the bejesus out of his people. That's a little kick for him. And on top of that,
I took it as he knew that if they thought an officer had done it, they're not going to report the car stolen, even though it is. So, like,
he says that in the car, where he's just like, by the time they realize it's too, like, I'm already gone. By the time they realize that they've been duped, like, I'm already out.
But that's not what Tom's saying, that it's a loss. If you think the FBI has come and taken the car, you're not even, especially if you're a criminal yourself, or if you're, you know, you're just going to write it off
as a loss. You're not going to get in a fight with law enforcement over your stolen car, because you know you're not going to win.
Right.
So, yeah, I think that was a very smart move. And while he made bad decisions and he was just a kid, it's like, man, that's a really smart point, right? He's doing dumb things. He's a criminal, but it's a really smart point. And it also hammers home that what's still relevant today is that the police are scary, because he says it makes you feel like you've got the whole army behind you when you see that badge. And I think that's a really poignant, impactful point, and that's made in the opening of
this
film.
I also think it illustrates that this character is a little bit more politically savvy than he's giving himself credit for.
Yeah, he's not political in terms of, like, he wants to improve his community. He's political in terms of he's manipulative. Like, he knows how to use his gifts, for lack of a better word, to get what he wants. This isn't about, I want to make the world better. It's about, how can I get
right.
that? Right, that's a different type of political... Manipulation at its core is a gift for evil.
Yeah, I mean,
you can convince people to do things that are for their detriment, whether it's your family, your community, your business, you know, whatever the situation is. I think that's where O'Neill lives. Now, the conundrum is, what they told him this organization is and what he sees that it is are two different things. And that's where he's like, what? You know what I mean? And there are attempts, small attempts, by him trying to say, no, that's not what's happening. And then, of course, you see Mitchell being like, are you becoming empathetic?
He starts to kind of question his loyalties, and if he's getting in a little bit too deep, which then puts the threat back on Bill that he's going to jail. Like, as great as Jesse Plemons is, and we have seen him so many times again in the last 10 years where he just pops up, you're like, oh man, he's so good. And in this one, the characters that he's playing can be very empathetic, where he's bringing Bill into his home, which is something that doesn't happen, right? Like, you don't bring your informant to your house. So he's buying him steak dinners. He's hooking him up with a car. He's doing all these different things.
He's not just buying him steak dinners. He's making him steak dinners, right? Like, he's waiting on him.
Yes.
And he brings him into clubs. Like, he's bringing him to areas, excuse the expression, to white-only areas that normally black people don't have access to apologize
because we're the ones that did it.
One, you don't feel comfortable. Yeah, and you don't have the money. So he's buying him nice scotch, nice piece of steak. You know, he's like, look, you too can have this if you continue down this path. And again, like you said, it's William O'Neill is selfish. He's not thinking about these other people. He wants a piece of the
pie. He's getting the money. He's getting the food. He's getting the booze. He's getting the car. Like, he's getting all this. He's getting a gas station.
He's treating O'Neill like an equal, right? He's treating him like a partner or a compatriot. And, you know, also keep in mind, it's 1969, right? So this guy would have come of age during the the civil rights civil era rights and movement. Jim Crow, right? Like, so like the idea that not only a white man, but a white police officer, an FBI agent is saying, come to my house. I'm going to make you dinner.
Right.
You sit there and here, don't just drink my scotch, drink my good scotch. Right. Like
meet my wife and my right, child, like that, it's bringing him into his family.
I think a lot of people in the present day, even though like we're aware, like we know what it was, you don't actually map out the timeline and really think about how like that affects the psyche of the people that were going through that.
Sure. Sure.
I think, yeah, well, a lot of people are going to. That's why I said is I think if this was playing in a movie theater, we got to understand like my grandmother was born into Jim Crow. That is, my grandmother did not vote until she was 30. And it was because she moved up north. It wasn't because of
right.
civil rights. But it's just, it's not as far removed as we like to right. think. Right?
Totally. Absolutely.
So I'm born in 70. So I'm really the first generation, if you want to do that math, that grew up not in necessarily segregation, that we moved a little bit more freely. Like, that wasn't my reality. Don't get me wrong. I mean, obviously, I understood there was racism, but I didn't have those type of confinements. Like, we weren't the first people at the post office or that worked at the bank. Or me going to college, my option wasn't primarily HBCUs. My option was wherever I could go to school. Do you know what I mean? So that is a huge... huge thing. And I will say, to my grandmother's credit, she never had us live in that bubble. She never, all her horrible experiences with white people, she never spoke ill of white people. She always wanted us to have our own perspective. She didn't want her experiences to be our worldview. And there have been some horrible things that she's seen. But to her credit, she somehow still believed in the good of people. Do you know what I mean? So I think we sometimes take it for granted that it's like, oh, like it happened in the 1930s. Yeah. Like, no, we're a lot of us were like the generation that was literally just born as a result of
sure.
this.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, we talked about him stealing the cars, and that's how we got picked up.
Can we talk about Dominique? Dominique, who plays Zebra?
Yeah.
I think we speak of young talent, and she hasn't been seen in a lot. A lot of you probably remember her from Power, Project Power. She was probably the best thing in that, you know. She was the poet. I think Dominique too is a young talent.
She's got some. She's got some heart wrenching performances. Yeah,
and I think that the only like one of my few issues with this is too. I wish she would have had a little bit of a bigger role, because women played an important part in the Black Panther Party. They were considered equal. One of few organizations didn't have the women make the coffee and type. They were out there. They were considered equal revolutionaries. But I do like her in this. She has a beautiful presence about her and a spirit, and she is a strong actress. And I'm looking forward to more things from
her. Yeah, and she's got some gut-wrenching scenes in this movie.
Yeah, she was really magnetic in the role, and I think anytime she was on screen, you're drawn to her presence. So she does seem just like a natural talent, and I did really like how in the movie, not only with her, but when you saw earlier the female member of the Black Panthers, and you know how she was there with them and riding in the car with them and had a gun, and you know there was no, like you said, they were equals. There was no superiority or inferiority between the men and women. They were there fighting alongside them and had equal roles. And so I do think the movie got that across very well with that one member that's along with them the whole time. But going forward in the story, so Bill O'Neill is facing 5 years of federal time.
On some charges that were elevated unnecessarily, right? Like,
he was impersonating a federal officer. He did that.
Yes, the Fed, Jesse Plemons gave him the maximum number of years that he could face, and that you always makes it sound worse when you get a higher number, right? But yes, he is faced with these charges, and then they figure out that
I mean, I think if he gave him 6 months, he would have done this. I mean, this kid
probably
Bill O'Neill is out for himself. 5 years isn't even that much time.
It's day
I'm
for
not
day.
Saying
no, it's different. It's so I mean, Fed time is if you go do federal time, you don't like get time off for good behavior. You do it every day.
But still, I mean, the kid is 17. I mean, he'd be out by 22. It's not life. I mean, it's 5 years. But my point is if he gave him 1 year, I think he would have said, okay, where's the Black Panther rally? I'm going to infiltrate. Right. You know, like Bill O'Neill
He was not that type of criminal where I'm going to sit here and take one for the team.
Yeah.
He would have taken anything. That's what you're saying is 100%. Yeah. He would have taken his get out of jail card.
Yeah.
I mean, I think also we got to talk a little bit about how we see the two sides of Fred. We see, obviously, the orator, very magnetic. We forget. We got to mention he was 21.
It's so young.
Yes. But he was very magnetic in his leadership, in his passion, in the movement. I do like that we see when he's with Deborah that he hadn't had a lot of romantic experience. Like, you know, like she kind of like had to take the lead because like you can't give hers. Like, that's not how you proceed with romance. You can't be like, I'm going to give a speech. And work. You know what I mean? That's not. And it's also I like it because it shows you that why men, when they like a woman, it's that awkwardness where you're like, you know, not to say that
we are
awkward.
No, we are.
Is that thing, you know what I mean? Where you like, I like her a little bit more than I just want to hook up. But how do I proceed? And, you know, and then you ask each other and that advice is usually bad. But I like that he was a little fumbling through that. You know what I mean? Like, at first they met on the political thing that they have in common, and she's passionate like he is, and she's there. But when they're alone, it's like, oh, now I got to talk to her. I can't just talk to her about politics. Like,
my favorite scene is when he's impersonating Malcolm X. That was first off, it was really good impersonation, but also it was very endearing of just like, you know, like he's trying to impersonate, like, I can sound like this, and but he also was like taking in the message but making it his own. Like, it worked on so many levels.
Yeah, and I think that's important because, you know, I think with Fred, because of how he died, he became very hero like very mystified, and to a certain point that I understand it, but we sometimes forget,
right,
these people are human. You know what I mean?
Sure,
that
sure.
means that while you're strong in some areas, you know, there has to have been doubt, fear, or, you know, he didn't give him the luxury because he understood what was the movement was bigger than any of his quips. So I think it's important that we did get to see that there were some imperfections.
And I will say that I think one of the things I really liked about this movie is that it wasn't, I mean, I think you definitely come away with positive impression overall of the Black Panthers, but it is kind of a warts and all thing. You see them kill police officers. They don't just not show you that and try to make them look like saints, but you also see maybe the backdrop against how those situations arose, to where you're like, well, you shouldn't have shot a cop, but I also get like your back's against the wall, like it. You know what I mean? Like, not to say it's okay, but like, it would have been very easy to just kind of omit that part of the story. And
sure.
Absolutely. And we see, you know, this, what we know now as Head Start came out of the Black Panther movement. Mm-hmm. You know, the breakfast in the school, the teaching kids from an earlier age. You know what I mean? Because, you know, education in the inner city is still caca.
Yeah.
Still the worst.
Outstanding use of the word caca, by the way, which is one that gets used around my house all the time.
And, you know, also clinics, understanding, you know, they were really implemental with getting funding into sickle cell anemia, which affects the Black community at high rates. So it's important, you know, it's important to see that they were more than the guys with the guns, because that's what, again, that's what the government wanted you to believe. Well, you know, they had the guns, so we needed to take care of them. But they were addressing things that were missing in the community. And, you know, hence we are still talking about healthcare, all of those things.
It's crazy to look at the similarities between the Black Panthers and the old school mafia, because that's what the old school mafia would do, right? Like that they were kind of formed to take care of their neighborhood and to keep riffraff and stuff they didn't want in the neighborhood out. So it's kind of cool to see like the similarities between the organizations and like their origins and stuff. But yeah, so Bill gets wrangled by the feds to kind of become their informant inside. And he works his way right next to Daniel Kaluuya quickly. Like he's got a car. They say that Fred can't drive anywhere because the cops were constantly pulling him over and giving him, you know, harassing him with tickets. So he just stopped driving. So he has a driver and Bill becomes that driver. And
well, you can see how dirty throughout the film that these cops are terrible. Trying to, they need to stop Fred Hampton because he's in charge of this movement. And so whether it's through traffic tickets and
doing whatever
the
they
car,
can,
he stops that. And then they ultimately get him for stealing $70 worth of ice cream.
It's 5 years and 5 years in state pen for ice cream.
Like, I mean, it's kind of like the whole tax evasion thing with Al Capone,
sure,
right?
Sure.
I mean, how it's like, you can't get this guy, and so you finally get them on these charges. Like,
yeah, you stretch it out because, again, they didn't have that type of money to be going to court for.
Right, right.
You know, endless foolery. But I think also, yeah, you do see that. The other part I think is important that we talk about is Fred was smart enough to be like, you know what? This will work better if we work with all the different.
I was just
franchises.
Gonna bring that up
and,
is that he goes out of his way to talk to the Puerto Ricans and to talk to the Southern guys, which I thought that scene was spectacular. Yeah.
And I think that's what got
what I thought was a Klan meeting, and I was like, Jesus, this is a bold move on your part, brother.
And that's what got him
but
killed, right? Like that scared the crap out of the government.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
When he makes it his job is to not just bring together the African American community, but to organize this coalition of
all the oppressed
all
people.
Exactly. And I do love that line when he's talking to the folks, the Southern folks, where he's just like, your kids are getting the same garbage education that our kids are. You're getting harassed by the same cops. Mm-hmm. Like if you join with us, there'll be more of us together. So he is putting together this super group, if you want to call it that, of the community, of the disenfranchised, of the people who are on the receiving end of discrimination. And that is when the government's like, holy shit, like this is we're in trouble, like this is bad, like he's gonna. So they take it upon themselves to get as much information on him as possible. And while they put Fred away for 5 years, Bill kind of steps up, and this is he kind of has a character.
It was like 2 years, right? He wasn't put away for five. It was like
was
two
it
to three,
okay?
I think.
It could have been, yeah. I guess that's true because Deborah's pregnant right before he goes in.
Right before she gets pregnant, right before he goes in, and it's also this idea, right? They're like, okay, we got him, so this situation's going to slow down.
Right, and they bomb the headquarters, and it's like, you know, and it's. And when I say they, I mean the police officers throw bombs into a building. And I think that's the moment when Bill sort of has a character turn and realizes that he's in too deep and he can't get out because he sees other groups come together who were enemies of the Black Panthers or adversaries, maybe not enemies, but definitely like at different ends of the spectrum, come in and start lending hands and helping and putting their place back together. And then Fred gets out and realizes he's got a baby on the way, and he kind of changes a little bit. He's not as staunch. Is that the right word? He's softened up a little bit.
Yeah, because you have a kid,
right.
And it, you know, a pregnant woman, seeing a woman pregnant, especially once she pops out, I mean, it does something.
It does. It does.
Like before, it's kind of like we're having a kid, but once you see it, you're like, oh snap! Like we really are.
It's all fun and games
kid.
Until there's that little life in your hands, yeah, exactly. And you're like, oh, this is real.
I don't want to speak to you, gentlemen, but I know for my husband, it was kind of like,
no, I definitely, I mean, the
you know, like we gotta like do something.
Holding my oldest for the first time was a sobering thing.
Yeah, you got another life to look up. Yeah, it's not just
it's
yourself
not just
anymore.
Me anymore. It's weird. As I was watching it, it kind of reminded me of Dogma, in that your Loki and Bartleby are both one way in the beginning of the movie, and then about halfway through they flip. And this movie kind of does the similar thing where Fred and Bill are on two opposite sides of the coin, and then about halfway through, and after Fred's child is born, they kind of flip sides, where Fred kind of becomes more diplomatic, where Bill is more like, nope, we got to kill him, because Bill has seen people that he has come up with in this organization get murdered. And he realizes,
well, and Bill is, the deeper he gets, he realizes that he's on the wrong side.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah, he definitely, yeah. And it's also, he's gotten to know these people, like, yeah, as people, not as this thing that he's been told about. Right. So he sees how they have each other's back, how they fight for one another, how they genuinely care. It's not a shtick. You know what I mean?
Well, the FBI can only lie to him so much. He's
right.
He sees the people.
Exactly. And I think there is this thing, and not just that, how the community depends on them, how the community embraces them, you know, and I think, you know, where it's definitely one of those things where he's in way too deep at that point. There is no out. Like, there's only one way out, like jumping off the roof, but, you know, he wasn't going to take that. But he is a man at a crossroads, and he cannot pick the right road.
So Fred's already been to jail once. He gets out. Nothing really changed, right? The Black Panthers slow down a little bit. He gets out. Now he's a hero. He's a kind of a martyr of sorts. I mean, they're, you know, the Black Panthers are back, and they're doing the same thing. And so J. Edgar Hoover realizes, I mean, Fred's going to go away to jail again, but it's not going to stop anything. And they're just getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
And stronger,
so the FBI, led by J. Edgar Hoover, says, we've got to stop Fred Hampton. And we mean stop.
They send in Rel, which I thought was funny. Like, when I saw his name in the credits, and I was like, what the hell kind of, what role is he going to play? And he plays this role. Yeah, right. That is just, it's terrifying. Like, Bill goes into a bar, kind of has a run in with this dude, and hands him this paper, and inside this paper is poison. And Bill's like, what do you want me to do with this? He's like, nah. Basically says, I can't do this. Like, I know what you're asking me to do. I cannot do this. And
he's just like, oh,
okay,
I got
cool.
the wrong guy,
right,
and walks away.
And then Bill freaks out, and he runs after the guy, and he's banging on his window. He's like, who are you? If you're a Fed, you got to tell me.
Oh, man. Show me your
badge.
When
you think he's going to show you his badge, we find out that it's Bill's fake badge that he had used in the beginning of the movie. And at that point, Bill knows, I'm screwed. We've got you.
Yeah, like, you're going to do this or else, like,
right.
I mean,
so,
yeah. If we do it, then you're not under our protection anymore. Like, either you do this or else, you know,
right,
we'll find someone else to do it, basically.
So Bill does it. He goes to a party, and he's beside himself, and he slips Fred poison in his drink. Was it just a sleep aid?
Yeah, so when they attacked, he wouldn't wake up and do anything. Yeah.
He wouldn't fight back.
Which is so heartbreaking when Deborah tries to wake him up. Well,
I can't help
go.
But think it's not to stop him from fighting back. It's to stop him from helping them navigate the situation in a way where they wouldn't fight back, right? Because what they want is for them to fight back.
Because
as soon as one of them pulls a gun, like, it's all over. And and we talked about the 94 shots into, you know, that the FBI did during this raid. But from what I read, the Black Panthers, there was one. There was one.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, there was one. And also, remember, Deborah was pregnant, so he definitely would have navigated the situation differently.
Was she pregnant, or did she have the baby at that point? Was she still pregnant?
No, she had the baby. She was still pregnant. She had the baby in December.
Okay.
So
they said, like, right after he died, right?
So
the night of this party, the feds attack. And that's the term that I'm going to use, is that's exactly what they did.
Well, they call it a raid.
They attacked.
But
like, that's
a
homicide.
Yeah, yeah, it's a murder.
They murdered it.
I mean, it wasn't a raid. Like, oh, you think of a raid. Oh, let's do a raid on this drug, you know, den.
Oh,
or
a
whatever.
Raid
you know,
is Waco, right?
Like, right. That's, there's a raid.
Yeah. Maybe that's not the best example.
Yeah,
but
that was a
with.
Calculated killing, is what they did.
Yes.
Is, yeah.
What is it they called in a court of justifiable homicide?
Justifiable homicide. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, they went in there like the cavalry and just shot everywhere. Yeah.
And
it's a hard scene
and
to
murdered,
watch.
And murdered and murdered a lot of people.
And I think one of the things we don't see in this film is the Panthers did later on bring the media and everybody into the scene for them to see all the bullets, for them to see the mattress, because they wanted people to know that the narrative that was being spun out there was not, how do you, why one guy, and like you said, the other guy that was also shot, and a pregnant woman, you needed this much firepower? Mm-hmm. Like, what, make that make sense, in other words. Like, I need you to think why they're spinning this like
right.
this. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, when you hear the shots, it does bring a chill on you. And you see Deborah, and you know the way that they manhandle her, not even respecting the fact that she is pregnant, like she's not a person. They didn't treat her like a person. And you know, and I do love how, you know, Dominique kind of like has that look on her face. She's got to process the fact that he's dead, and at the same time keep her senses because she is pregnant. You know what I mean? She's like, I'm not having this baby in front of these people.
Her face in that scene. Yeah.
She flips a switch. That scene
she figured out she's got to keep it together
right.
because she is pregnant. And Deborah said something I thought was very important. She said I wasn't going to cry in front of these people. They weren't going to get that
right.
from me. And I think that's what Dominique was giving us, where like, I'm going to grieve, but they're not going to see
right
that.
Yeah.
And that's how it ends, is we get, you know, we get some stingers, we get a last interaction between Bill and Jesse Plemons.
He gets the gas station. That's where he gets the gas.
Jesse Plemons is like, you did a great job. You did a great job, kid. Like, here's the cash. And
well, Neil's ready to, like, now that they're basically done with him, he's waiting to like have a bunch of feds jump on him.
Right.
And Mitchell's like, I know you don't trust me, but it's okay. Like, come sit down, come eat. You did a good job. Like, no one's going to do anything.
You're
to
okay.
You.
And gives him a gas station.
Yeah, rewards him. With a gas station.
Imagine that. You helped kill someone and you get a gas station.
Right, and you get some stingers and Fred's family.
And so you see the end of the interview that opened the film with O'Neill that's based on that documentary, and then you see the real footage of him.
Yeah.
And you get to see, and you see that, you know, Fred. He's like, history, let history decide, you know? And
well, and so, yeah, you get some stingers and you just say that Fred Jr. is now the chairman of the that chapter of the Black Panther Party.
That eat young cubs.
Yeah,
and
right.
And Deborah are very much, you know, fighting to keep Fred's legacy alive. He's doing something right now where Fred Hampton's childhood home, they're trying to save it.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? And he is, she gives lectures. Every now and then. She's very guarded, though, and understandably so, about the interviews she gives. There are not a lot of interviews out there. There's a couple right when this was going on, again, to keep the narrative to understand. They did sue the city of Chicago. It took about,
12 years, I think it said. It was the longest, like, civil suit against the federal government ever.
They settled out of court, and when William O'Neill did die, she, like a lot of us, normal, you know, she had it in her head that she was going to spit on him. And when she saw him, she was like, that doesn't look like him. That's not him, because he wasn't as intimidating of a figure.
Oh, sure,
as,
sure.
You know, yeah, he had shrunk as a man. And she was like, at that point, she was like, everything that I had been holding on to, you know what I mean? And I was finally going to get my piece out of there. And I see this man in this casket and I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah. So we should say that the night that the documentary airs on PBS, the night of its airing, Bill committed suicide. He saw himself on TV, and that was kind of it.
I mean, he couldn't, the film speaks for itself, right, for what you will.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Then, I mean,
imagine though, like, he knew that once people were like, the guy with the gas station is the guy responsible. I mean, first of all, business would have been done. He would have been shunned from the community. Or also, somebody might have taken it upon themselves to be like, I'm going to end you because you ended him. You ended a lot of hope. And also, I got to think that he kind of like did that interview to get some weight off.
Yeah, sure.
I think also, Eyes. So he was in the Eyes on the Prize 2 documentary, and Eyes on the Prize was like just a massive hit for PBS. I mean, it was a huge documentary. It was, I mean, it was like almost as big as Ken Burns' Civil War when it aired. I mean, it was a massive event. So I also can't help but think that, like, part of that too is he knew by giving that interview, he pretty much solidified his legacy by granting that interview on such a high profile platform. You know what I mean?
Yeah. We got to help people understand we didn't have cable as we know it. We definitely did not have streaming. It was like, I was about to say 3, 6, and 10, but I forget we were all different places. But ABC, CBS, NBC, whatever you had on UHF. I know I'm dating myself, you know, where I'm from, it was like 29.
Yeah, we were
and
30, and channel 30 is what we had, yeah.
Exactly.
24.
Exactly. So whatever your Kung Fu theater came on, put it in old people terms. So we didn't have, so PBS was major. That's where you got all your culture from. So, you know, if you wanted to see what was happening on Broadway or, you know, greatest, you know, a play or anything that was happening like in the UK, like those shows and those movies, that's what you watch PBS. So what Tom is saying is when that was coming on, America tuned in, like, you know, because we knew it was going to be, you know, interesting. We were going to learn something. And to watch that, America definitely was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, I think
he what they told us it was.
I mean, he knew what he was doing by granting that interview, and then clearly by taking his life afterwards. That was him, you know, saying goodbye.
Because the FBI definitely would have came and been like, "What are you doing?"
Yeah, right. Right. You know what I
mean? So, I mean, this movie, phenomenal performances, a really interesting story and an important one that needs to be told. And I mean, like I said, I wasn't familiar before, and I'm really glad that I was able to learn more about it. And this is one that people should watch.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think, you know what it will be? I think if we, knock on wood, we get off punishment and everybody gets vaccinated, and I pray everybody does, please go get vaccinated when you get a chance. I think they'll re-release it in theaters, and I think people will want to be able to see it together. I do think that they did a good thing by having it come on HBO Max, because again, we don't know the state of theater. I think we have to establish that trust, not because, you know, people don't want to go to the theater. It's a health crisis type of thing. We got to establish trust with each other, you know, why we might go. I think, you know, I can speak for a lot of us. I don't think we're scared about the theater being clean. We don't want to deal with the people that don't want to do the right thing.
Fair.
That's not
fair.
Worth the price of admission, like you getting into a shouting match with crazy people.
Right. Yeah, right.
So now I'm glad people got to see this
movie. Absolutely.
I know, before we get out of here, I know that Dan used to dive into the salt mines. I'm going to come up a little bit higher, maybe just like on the crust of it.
Pepper mines?
A really good... yeah, that's fine. We'll work with that. There's a really good graphic novel by David Walker and Marcus Kwame Anderson called The Black Panther Party. It's a graphic novel history of the party. You can get it on Amazon. You can kind of get it wherever. I just thought it was a nice little aside to this story. That it's David F. Walker's a fantastic writer. He's actually got a new show on the WB coming next fall. So I just wanted
and
to give that
for people to see that this is my feel on things, right? Whatever it is, whether it's Glory or whatever it's the thing is that you watch on a movie theater, it is a point of entry. It is not the Bible for the history. It is supposed to move you to learn more, right? At least if you're a learner person. So reading this, going on YouTube, watching the interview, Eyes on the Prize, it's a hard thing to watch.
reading things, watching other documentaries, hopefully it will open up your mind and give you a better understanding of who the Black Panthers were, so that you're not getting like a single point of view. I just think they're giving you this opening and we should walk through
Absolutely.
It.
There you go.
Well, I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the virtual table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at Joey Butts, B-U-T-T-S 21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And Katia, where can people find you?
People can find me at Katia_Woods. I'm the same person on everything, and you can read most of my writings on coppersoulshow.com. And, you know, we're about to dive into another film festival because we're glutton for punishment. but the nice thing is, I like that we're able to see more things. And I like the fact that more of my fellow critics are able to see these things, because as we know, we have families and sometimes these trips are hella expensive.
Absolutely. And you can find me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. Find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, don't forget our Patreon, patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Marcus refuses to plant a gun on Do-Right.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot. Real spoilers. Real spoilers. Real spoilers.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.